You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 183.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. I feel like I don't have to say welcome at the beginning anymore because I think the woman who comes on for the intro already says welcome. So I don't think that's necessary.
Well, you can never make our listeners, viewers, listeners feel too welcome, can you?
Yeah, I guess
you're
right.
Don't answer that.
I guess you're right. Okay, I promise the studio will have one new thing every time we do a video. Of course, I got a little frame here from HomeSense or whatever that is. So there you go. We'll do something a little bit more dramatic next time, though. I promise you that.
Classing it up one piece at a time.
Yeah. Okay, so today we're going to talk about some current events. We're going to talk about the metaverse and Facebook. And then we are going to talk about the theory of digits, because the metaverse will be made up entirely of digits. So why don't I just go back to basics and talk about some of Max's, that's me, my old philosophical musings on digits.
Yes, but what kind of digits? Stay tuned to find out.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so this news article we didn't read, but isn't it crazy that Australia is apparently ready to deploy their military to do the COVID lockdowns? We're still in the COVID era, all right. You know, this is
when you say it like that, it sounds scary and disastrous. And,
yeah.
And I also did not read the article, so I'm completely unqualified to comment on this, and I will not let that stop me.
Okay,
but
then we'll get into the real stuff. We actually did 30 seconds of research on.
I'd say to very briefly steel man it that maybe it's less ominous declaration of martial law, and it's more kind of like post-hurricane sending out the National Guard to help with disaster relief. Until proven otherwise, I'm going to give them a little bit of the benefit of the doubt on that one. But
man,
we'll see.
I don't know.
Got to keep an eye on the sneaky Australians.
I feel like it's to keep people in their homes. Like, that would be like, imagine if you had like soldiers outside of your home, like in your neighborhood, making sure that no one's going out. That would be kind of scary.
Well, everyone was talking in mid to late 2020 about how like nature was rebounding and plants and animals were kind of retaking the country.
Yeah, did that happen?
I don't know how true that. I think there were some things that did.
I heard a little bit more birds, but it wasn't. Yeah.
I don't think Australia needs that. I think the wildlife there is dangerous and aggressive enough as it is. How can you further weaponize, scorpions, and was it like, 75% of all poisonous snakes live in Australia or something ridiculous? It's not a place that needed to be more wild and dangerous.
Gotcha. Okay.
Maybe that's what they're deploying the military to combat.
I hope so. Have you ever heard of, and this is kind of a meme, of the Great Emu War?
I have.
Yes.
I've not deeply researched on it, but I believe the emus won.
Yes, it was the cartoon version of it, which I prefer, is that Australia deployed its military against the emus because there was a big emu problem. They were overpopulating, and apparently the emus won. So I love that. I love that description of that war. Okay. Let's go on to something that we know about a little bit. Let's talk about Facebook and some of Mark Zuckerberg's statements on the metaverse. Now, first of all, like, what is the metaverse? This actually comes from a book that you and I read in high school around the same time,
yep.
Like Snow Crash, Neal Stephenson. I'm really surprised that this idea stuck. This was a book from 1992. We weren't reading it in 1992. We're not that old. I mean, I guess I was alive in 92, but
it was late 90s, maybe early 2000s.
I think it was early 2000. Basically the idea is that it's a whole other universe that exists digitally, but not like the internet. Like, you could actually implant it's essentially a virtual reality world. You feel like you're there. It's kind of like a massively multiplayer game, except it's kind of like, you know, you meet people there, you hang out. If I remember correctly, I haven't read the book recently, but I know that, you know, you kind of spawn in like waiting room areas and then you kind of go out into the world and you travel around it. You could build things in it, that sort of thing. So it's sort of a digital meeting place, if you will. And it was always, this is like kind of an exciting chapter when you're like, you're going into the metaverse and you're meeting other people and then you're going back out into the real world. How would you describe it? Is that how you would describe it or?
Yeah, I think it was somewhat inspired by some very early, MMO type games, but it then went on to itself spawn, it served as a major inspiration for, Second Life, which some of our older listeners might be aware of, which was kind of it didn't revolutionize the space, but it captured a lot of people's imagination for what could be done in that kind of virtual worlds with avatars and people interacting, not just for the purposes of playing a game, but as being a platform or an interface for wide spanning interactions. So it wasn't that you were logging into World of Warcraft. It was that you were logging into a virtual world where you could do pretty much anything.
Okay. So it's not a game. It's actually a functional space. Why is Facebook trying to do? I guess the question to ask is, why is he talking about this? Is this actually an imminent thing? You know, and if it's not, since like spoiler alert, it's not imminent. Like, what's their plan to bring this about? And you know, why should we care? I mean, in part of me says, you know, some of this said, you know, hey, Mark Zuckerberg believes that VR, virtual reality, is the next mobile. And the article also points out that Facebook was actually somewhat late to mobile. They dominate in mobile applications today, but that was with the help of some acquisitions of companies like Instagram and WhatsApp. And also, maybe they copied a little something from Snapchat. Just a little. Take a quick look and see, and drag and drop. But I almost wonder if this could be, if this is based on real market data, or if this is some kind of a psychological compensation where not just Mark Zuckerberg, but the Facebook executive team is thinking like, well, we want to be early to the next thing. So obviously this is a jump to mobile. And so the next one is obviously the jump to VR because it's kind of like the mobile of mobile. So, but I don't know if it's based on any real data that's available or real kind of, I don't know what the arguments are to support the idea that virtual reality is going to be the next big platform. I mean, maybe it could be a big platform down the road, but
it's not something that consumers are clamoring for right now.
Right.
But perhaps they're taking a, if you build it, they will come approach here. And it shouldn't be that surprising given the huge investment that they made in VR by acquiring Oculus, and the,
it's been a while.
Disappointing, output of that acquisition collaboration. I mean, it's not that it's falling completely on its face, but it hasn't revolutionized the company and the VR industry in the way that I think they were kind of hoping with that. So if consumers are not clamoring for it, then they will need to make it something that consumers clamor for. But I think you were definitely right about maybe overcompensating a little bit, wanting to make sure that they're first actors in the space, even if that means that they have to act on a bunch of spaces that never pan out, just so that when the next big thing does come along, they've got a foot in the door. I think they're maybe a little bit anxious that when everyone went to, well, not everyone, but when a huge amount of the American workforce went work from home in 2020, that they didn't have the killer solution to that. You know, people were going to, you know, we saw Zoom come kind of from a no name to be, the you know, they became the Xerox of video conferencing.
He took some digs at Zoom in some other statements I saw. You know, if I could skip ahead here a little bit,
sure,
to say, but you know, it said here, like, you know, he told The Verge people shouldn't live through small glowing rectangles, and then of course my addendum is it needs to be a large glowing dome instead. But you know, he said, well, you know, interactions shouldn't be just a bunch of squares with faces on them. And I actually agree with that. I think that's a horrible way to interact. I'm going Zoom crazy. I don't know about you. But I think part of those, you know, part of those digs, part of them like talking shit is probably about, oh my God, like, you know, Zoom had the solution and we didn't. So, you know, let's talk about those squares and faces and how ridiculous it is.
Yeah, I think there's a certain amount that they don't particularly care about the metaverse. It's just a vehicle to make sure that people are spending more time in front of Facebook content that can be, you know, advertised to or data mined or whatever their future profit model is. They want to make sure that it's not a platform owned by somebody else.
So remember, this reminds me almost of when Facebook tried to come out with their own cryptocurrency called Libra. I don't even know. They changed the name of it, didn't they? I don't even remember what it was, but what they changed it to.
And yeah, I think it got somewhat disaffiliated from Facebook. You know, I'm sure that there's still deep ties.
Oh yeah, now it's called DM.
But yeah, they wanted to maybe lessen the public relations linkage there.
It still doesn't exist. Well, I knew this was going to happen, you know.
I think may have made an explicit prediction about that on the air.
yeah, exactly. Because they want a closed system. They want a walled garden for everything. And almost like the government, if there's kind of an open solution that everyone can use and that's free and fair, they're like, well, this isn't helping us. So they want to have their own. And not everything in the world should work like Facebook. In fact, I think even Facebook shouldn't work like Facebook. But I'll let them have their own space.
Well, in the notes you made a comment about you know, should the metaverse be open?
Yeah.
To give some context, the original metaverse, the Neil Stephenson's metaverse, it was structured in such a way that all the real estate in the metaverse initially belonged to the Global Multimedia Protocol Group, does not actually exist, but in the fictional universe of Snow Crash, it was a subsidiary, a part of the Association for Computing Machinery, which is a real nonprofit that exists.
It almost sounds like, you know, because this is coming out in the 90s, so there's a different sort of an intellectual soup you're pulling from here. So that almost sounds like a Wikimedia Foundation type.
I think it might be a little bit
more of an open source Apache or something.
What is it? Is it ICANN that handles the allocation of IP addresses?
Okay, yeah.
Because in the way real estate was broken up in the metaverse, as I recall, it was not unlike an IP addressing scheme. That, you know, obviously it's the digital world, so everything was powers of two. I think it was like there were, you know, 256 stops on so. The metaverse was spanned by a single main street that runs around the sphere.
Yeah.
And it has, there's a monorail that runs along it, and it has 256 stops, each of which is 256 kilometers apart from each other. And so
Right. Each
of those, there's like an express address and then a local port address for those. And so that determines like where you log in or log out of the metaverse from, where those portals are.
Gotcha. I wonder, I mean, I'm guessing if he came up with it today, there'd be some kind of a blockchain component to it. It almost sounds like it, right?
Oh,
like,
I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah.
You would have to be able to prove that you legitimately owned this metaverse real estate.
Right.
Although it does sound like there wasn't really any discussion of whether the computing power that ran the metaverse was centralized or distributed. That wasn't really something that was in the forefront of people's minds at that point.
Right. And that's a good question. We never really, I don't know how much it got into how much it worked. So Okay. I don't know if there's anything else. Oh, I found this article from the Wall Street Journal about Facebook, just how involved...
Before we jump onto that, one more thing I wanted to throw out when we were talking about open versus closed. I think a big part of it is going to be them determining exactly what their objective with this metaverse play is. If it's purely that they want to sell more VR hardware, if they want to find a way to add value to make their Oculus hardware worthwhile, then I would expect it's going to be a proprietary kind of closed source system. Right. However, if their move here is that the platform is going to be a method for getting more eyes on Facebook content, getting people to spend more time in their environment, I could very much see a model where maybe Facebook Oculus provides the premium experience for the metaverse, but it is an open enough protocol that Samsung and every other designer of mid to high level hardware can interface with it, and maybe there's some top tier features that only those who buy Facebook hardware can access, but the value of eyeballs is greater to them perhaps than the value of hardware sales. So it remains to be seen what they're really trying to do with this space, because right now it's all just buzzwords.
Because it's not like they let you post on Facebook
and closed.
It's not like they let you post on Facebook from other social networks. So
right.
They're not, I mean,
well, and
they're
and
not
we've
on
talked
Mastodon.
About that with Mastodon versus something like Twitter, which, it gets exactly to the library versus Odyssey concept that you talked about in a previous episode.
Or Odyssey versus YouTube.
That there's the under, well, yeah, sorry, not versus, but just there's like the underlying infrastructure, which anybody can use. And then there's a specific kind of a portal that you can view it through. But that doesn't mean that interface can be used to add content.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. I mean, and the Wall Street Journal article is just about how Facebook is not just thinking about what's next in terms of technology and consumer needs, which is probably, what they were trying to think about 10, 15 years ago. Now, most of what they do is worrying about politics and what the politicians are going to do to them, or what they're going to do to the politicians, or something or other. And so this is a Wall Street Journal article. It's a right-leaning article, but it kind of points out that, Facebook tried to tip the scale during the election to help Biden, and it may be working with the administration now on misinformation. That was a whole big thing where, Jen Psaki said, we're working with companies like Facebook to identify misinformation. But Facebook is still the biggest vector for uncensored information, and they haven't been able to censor it all. They haven't been able to get it all, and so it's on things like vaccines and all that. So it's one of the biggest vectors for sharing information. Period. And so, this article argues, I don't know, I'm not necessarily taking a position on it, but it's an interesting idea. Argues that it's a huge risk for Facebook that the administration or the progressives kind of turn on Facebook, and then you have a situation where both parties want to destroy Facebook. And there's been kind of like all this crazy rhetoric going on where people will say, hey, someone on your platform posted something critical of the vaccines, therefore you, Facebook, are killing people, And so that's how people go today.
It's
always
just someone
over the
that's
top.
Saying those things. It's the president of the United States that's making those comparisons.
Oh, was it the president? Okay. I think that almost, I thought it was someone more important. Never mind. Okay. rhetoric these days is over the top. It has been for at least, I don't know, 5-6 years.
Yeah.
Changed in like 2013.
If Facebook is not spending serious amounts of money on PR and legal and lobbying consultants to mitigate this risk, then I don't know what they're doing with their billions of dollars.
I feel like
this is a real risk, but I think they're going to weather it okay.
I feel
they're
like
just going to put a lot of effort in.
Part of the reason for this over the top rhetoric that's popular these days is platforms like Facebook.
You're not wrong. So,
it might all come full circle on
them. There's the question of, I mean, yes, it's a partisan thing, but it's not partisan in the sense that only one party has a beef with Facebook.
They
for different reasons, perhaps, but they all want to take it down a notch. And I think I am.
They
I
might
am
not agree
to
how
believe
to do it.
That part of this is there's a saying that I'm sure I'm going to butcher, but it's something about, you know, either executive power or, you know, deficit spending and that kind of thing, that you only oppose it until you're in power. And then you forget that it was part of your platform to be against it. I think politicians are only going to rail against Facebook either until they destroy it or until they, perhaps more preferably to their view, find a way that they can co-opt it to serve their purposes, at which point Facebook will be able to do no wrong and they're a model company again. So.
Well, I think that there's kind of an internal contradiction in that statement of like, so one of the things they want to do is break up Facebook. One of the things they're talking about doing is breaking up Facebook. But they're like, well, we'll break up Facebook because they're not getting rid of all the misinformation we want them to get rid of. But then you break it up and now all of the constituent parts are free to not censor misinformation. So now you have an even harder problem.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's perhaps an argument to be made that a larger, more
and I always I want to point
Facebook.
Out I'm kind of putting going in the government point of view just to say personally I don't want any of this stuff censored. But let's go because there could be new people on the show.
Let's take as a given for a moment that there is harmful misinformation out there, and we want to be able to effectively remove that information.
Let's jump
from the
into
platform.
That point of view. Yes.
So from that perspective, you could make an argument that a larger, more consolidated, more powerful Facebook is better positioned to do that. And that's your classic, the classic argument that you make when you're pitching a merger. It's that by our powers combined, we will be more effective and we can save the consumer money. The counter to that would be that by breaking the company up, you create competition, and those competing factions are then able to offer alternatives rather than just doing the same thing better and harder. They can take a different approach. That being said, I am highly skeptical that any way they break up Facebook would result in groups that directly compete with each other. It's much more likely we would see a breakup like, okay,
first
you
got to
separate out your Snapchat and your Facebook.
Yeah.
But that's not going to change any of these dynamics.
Because we're talking about Facebook, the social network, is where all of the criticism comes in. Maybe a little bit on WhatsApp and Instagram. But let's talk about Facebook, the social network. Like, you can't break up that Facebook. Like, it's not, it. How do you, what do you say? Okay, yeah, I'm sorry, you're in a different Facebook. I can't message you now.
It's like, not like when they broke up AT&T
and
they had a bunch of different regional phone companies. You're not going to get, you know, Facebook New England and Facebook Southwest,
that's how they started.
Conferences or something.
They started out like that, which is, I remember when it was like that.
Right, it was
college, is university.
It was never like regionally restricted. You could see anyone else who was on Facebook, but the rollout was very, very small groups.
But I think there was like more of a, like, I remember, and this is, I could be wrong about this, early on, where there was kind of like an out of network section and an in network section. So like I was on the Yale network, and it was like, I could see more.
Yeah, you're right. There was a period when you couldn't just randomly friend anyone. You needed to have like degrees of connection or something.
Ah, interesting. Yeah.
This is reaching way back into the memory of what, like 2005, 2006?
Yeah. 2004 I got on.
So long ago.
I know. It's been all downhill since.
Had so much more hair back then.
Okay. So a few other things that he mentioned before we moved on. He mentioned the idea of working on an infinite office that allows users to create their ideal workspace through VR This is from the BBC article. I'll quote him. In the future, instead of doing all this over a phone call, you'll be able to sit as a hologram on my couch, or I'll be able to sit as a hologram on your couch, and it'll actually feel like we're in the same place, even if we're in different states or hundreds of miles apart. He said, I think that's really powerful. Okay, but is that imminent? Is that 5 years ahead? I'll believe it
when I see it. Exactly. I think this is one of those things that they could definitely do as a tech demo, but how useful is it really going to be?
How would I appear as a hologram on your couch without all sorts of equipment around me?
Well, yeah, either you're going to be wearing the virtual goggles,
yeah,
or there's got to be some sort of projection setup.
I mean, it would be cool if there's a room in my house I could just walk into, and it's like, and if you walk into a room in your house, then we're together. But like, if I have to set up a whole bunch of stuff and then I have to call you at the right time, it's not as good as it, I don't know.
I think this technology may have a lot in common with the early concepts for touchscreens. That it's a technology that's found use, mostly on phones and tablets. But the initial idea was something much more like, Minority Report.
Yeah.
Where that was a gestures-based thing. But people were envisioning large touchscreens that would replace monitors. And so, but no one is going to spend all day reaching out, moving their hand around on the screen because your arm gets fatigued. And it turns out a mouse and keyboard are sometimes more effective for that type of stuff.
Right.
And so, yes, touchscreens are a very important part of our everyday technology use, but not in the way that they were being envisioned for the first decade or so of development of the technology.
Gotcha.
So I think we need to be prepared for some dramatic changes in how this VR tech gets used. There was one other quote.
Maybe it could be something like on your phone that you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, again, it's going to take the phone manufacturers many years to integrate something like a 3D camera that's any good.
So there was one other quote that came up when they were talking about the metaverse that I wanted to pull out from that BBC article. And it was really towards the end of it. Let's see, here it is.
Is it the behavioral data part? Because that one.
It was actually after that.
Oh, okay.
So it was, tech giants like Facebook defining and colonizing the space, while traditional government structures struggle to keep up with the technological change, could cause further issues, she added. If you couldn't tell already from the language used in that statement, this is definitely an academic talking about it with their concerns about the colonization of the metaverse. Just to be clear, there are no natives in the metaverse who are being displaced or enslaved, just friendly ones and zeros. I don't know if you want to use that as a segue there, but I think...
we'll get into that a little bit.
Those concerns are perhaps being viewed through a strange light there. Granted, if it is a environment that is fully owned by the Facebook corporation, then I have other concerns. I don't know if I'd use colonization to refer to them, but the company store is not a great model either.
That's just the way people talk
company
now.
Company town.
Yeah, that's just the way people think now. So I don't know. Here's the part with the behavioral data was interesting. It's a little bit of kind of projecting what is now onto what will be then. And so I hope this projection doesn't hold, but they're like, they want the user data to advertise to us. I mean, I was personally involved in, not in Facebook, but in online advertising based on data. It's nuts. It's the nuttiest industry. I don't even know how to describe how nuts it is. But anyway, they're saying, okay, if you're in VR, it's not just going to be about where you click or what you share. According to this, it's like, it's how you stand, where your eyes look, what you're looking at the longest, the subtle ways you physically move your body. And all of that is going to be used to advertise to you. And it's a direct route to your subconscious. That sounds pretty nuts. I mean, I hope it, it almost sounds like you seem like a nervous wreck. Maybe here's some drugs to help you. Like, what's it going to do?
I mean, eye tracking is already super valuable for that kind of thing. And if they're doing, full body motion capture as part of this VR, AR experience, then that's a whole lot more data that they could potentially be mining for useful insights there.
Hmm. Okay, cool. I mean,
think if Facebook could basically have an always active lie detector on every interaction that you have on the platform.
Okay, what would it use? What would it use it for?
Well, I think it would be particularly useful to some groups, whether they're corporate or governmental, to know everything that you've said and when you were lying about it, and or being able to have a kind of a custom tuned database, so when they want to pull you in for questioning, they can use all of that data to improve the performance of their lie detector system.
Now that sounds really dystopian. I was thinking more in terms of ads, but
If we can use it to throw you in jail, we can use it to sell you things too.
That
sword cuts really, both ways.
Yeah, yeah. You said you wanted to block that ad, but you're kind of lying. You kind of want it. you want this new couch, don't you? Okay.
Would you like to go into private browser mode? We think you want to go into private browser mode.
We've got some stuff to sell you in there. Don't worry. No one will have to know. Only 8 billion people. It's only between you and Facebook. No one has to know. Okay. So that's what's going on Facebook. Kind of, I don't think... I think just to wrap this up, I don't think this is something that's going to happen imminently, but I think it's interesting that they're talking in this direction. They've wanted to go in the VR direction for this long. I think he's trying to they're trying to ramp it up a little bit by going from VR to metaverse, trying to make it cooler. Facebook is almost trying to grab onto the next big thing. They're really trying to find it. They also have political issues at the same time. So very interesting predicament that Facebook is in, and I feel like it's very hard to predict how this is going to play out.
Yeah, and particularly to see what some of the
and I hope they build something good, like
the norms of such a platform would become, because in Snow Crash's metaverse, they come right out right from the beginning of the explanation of this concept that there was all sorts of wacky stuff you would see walking down Main Street. It wasn't just people dressed up as cyberpunk detectives. You literally had giant penises walking down the street, because when your avatar can be anything, that's what you're gonna get.
I feel like that's Twitter. That's
I think he was pretty on the nose with people's online personas even before that was a thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sure he was on message boards and things like that, and people were using fake names. So you could probably see weren't there people with like numbers in their names in that book?
It was like the leet speak. I don't know if I can't imagine he invented that, but I think there was. Yeah, was it Dayfivid?
Dayfivid, I called him. I feel like that's not what you're supposed to call him, but it's like D-A-5.
I think it's supposed to be just David, but yeah, there's a five.
I always called it Dayfivid.
Yeah. which I believe was loosely based on Sid Meier, but I don't quote me on that.
Okay. Cool. All right. So let's go into digits. Now, why am I interested in digits? I'm interested in computer science, the metaverse, the blockchain, the phone in your pocket. It's all based on these ones and zeros, or theoretically, it doesn't have to be a binary system. It could be any digital system. It's based on digits. We're talking about people with digits in their names. So,
maybe take a step back, because most of this is based on binary, a two-digit system,
right?
But why?
For computers. So actually, I don't really know the answer to that, other than I think it has to do with, like, it's just easier to make circuits.
I having not researched this before the episode, I believe you're right that it's, it comes.
And I think you can make circuits that are zeros, ones, and twos, or
right.
zero, or, ones, and twos, and threes. And I think there have been
zero, one, and negative one.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can do things like that, but from a design perspective, even back in the analog days, You know, having a basically on and off was a lot easier to design for rather than having multiple intervening levels that you then had to accurately read.
And if I remember correctly, I think early on computers, there were some people who tried to design computers with base 10 digits because they're like, well, this is how we count in base 10. So we might as well, you know, put 10 digit numbers right into the hardware. I guess that fell out of favor because I guess just binary was just more efficient or just became the standard, something like that. But yeah, I think you're right that I'm right. so aren't we just all right today? Let's just define that as truth then. I'm more interested in like the theoretical underpinning of digits. And ever since like I was in, you know, elementary school, one of the things that blew my mind when I was like 10 was that like numbers don't have to be base 10. I don't know if you remember learning that for the first time, but it's like the fact that base 10 is an arbitrary decision is kind of funky. It means the way we think about numbers is from a very particular perspective that you know, an alien might not have. It's kind of interesting to think about, well, what is a digit and what other number systems can be built up from those digits? And I want to talk, and I'll get into the Cora answer I gave a while back, which was very interesting. So I just want to say the Wikipedia definition of digits is that a digit is a symbol used to represent values in a positional number system. So,
what's, so Roman numerals would not be digits because they are not purely positional in their representation.
Right. So there are all of the early number systems were not positional. And a positional number system, you could say, was like a really great innovation because it's so much easier to work with numbers that are like we have today. Whereas, you know, Roman numerals are just, hey, you want an extra 5 in there, throw in a V. You want an extra 50 in there, throw in an L. So it's basically like counting sticks and then crossing off the fifth stick, but just doing it, essentially that is Roman numerals. They just do it more complicated.
Advanced version of that. Yeah.
It's an advanced version of that. And so it makes it harder to add and really hard to multiply. And, So positional number systems are really useful, but they are, depending on what base you're in or what number system you're in, it's going to be easier for some things and harder for other things. So for example, in base 10, it's really easy to multiply by 10.
Makes sense.
Yeah. It's also kind of easy to multiply by 5 because 5 is half of 10. So, you know, you could also, to multiply by 5, you could multiply by 10 and try to half it. And you have all sorts of different options. It's not so easy to multiply by 7 or 3, even though, you know, maybe a base 6 would be a lot easier to multiply by 3. Base 2, binary, when you have ones and zeros, the cool thing about that is that if you want to multiply by 2, now you're just adding zeros to it instead of multiplying by 10. So depending on how you choose your base, you know, certain things are easier and certain things are harder.
Now, do you have a favorite base system?
No, but I'm going to talk about a novel one at the end that's really complicated, and I don't think anyone will ever use it, but I think it's a really cool idea. So hold off to the end for a second. So in terms of favorite, I think... So of the ones that let's talk about the interesting ones. First of all, there's base 10. That's the one we use. Binary is not just interesting because it's used by computers, but it's also it's really the smallest base that you could have. Now my Cora answer is about what is base 1 and what is base 0. So we'll get into that in a second, but binary is something that I think, would be, more like if you wanted a universal language, would be more acceptable than digits.
And it's not purely a computer's thing because, you know, Morse code is basically a, I mean, I guess you're not doing mathematical operations, but it is in essence a binary system.
Sure.
You're representing more complex messages using ones and zeros or dits and dots.
Dots and dashes. Yeah. So another one I'll mention is base 7 I like in terms of learning about bases, because that's the one that gets really different from base 10, mm-hmm. but the numbers have like kind of the same amounts. Like if it's a 3-digit number in base 10, it'll probably be a 3-digit number in base 7, maybe 4. But it looks totally different. So I feel like base 7 is an interesting one for learning. And it's really, it's kind of freaky if you've ever played with that, where how you, to multiply by 7, now you add a 0 at the end of the number. It's like, why is multiplying by 7 so easy? It almost feels like something's wrong here. So people don't mention that one a lot, but I mentioned that one because for some reason, 7 being like a prime number and like 5 is also a prime number, but it's like it's part of base 10, so we're kind of used to it. So something about basing it off 7 is it's almost like the weirdest one to use between 2 and 10, if that makes sense. And so another one to mention is hexadecimal, which...
Yeah, I was going
to
say, that's one that I run into a lot and have failed to develop any sort of intuition for.
Okay, so hexadecimal is base 16, and so the digits that they use are 0 through 9 and then A through F. Now, if you've ever seen color pickers online, that's, I think, 6 hexadecimal digits. So I think if you have F, 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 that is... Is that black or is that white? It's one of those. And then 0000. I think it's white. And I think 0000000. How many zeros did I say? 6 zeros is black, something like that. But anyway, the first two represent the red value, the second two, the green value, and the third two, the blue value. What's really great about hexadecimal is that it's still a small number of digits, 16, so it's manageable. You kind of memorize them, and you could kind of easily recognize it. If you are a programming professional such as I, you will immediately recognize a hexadecimal number by the fact that it only has A through F's in the string. And I think other people recognize it as well. I think it's very easy to recognize.
It's much trickier to tell when it only has digits 0 through 9. Because it could be a hexadecimal.
Yeah.
But so that's usually a thing. There's some notation that will indicate.
That's the thing about digits is that whether you're in hexadecimal or base 2 or base 7 or base 10, if I have the digit 1, because all of those have a 1 in it, I'm not telling you, like, is that 1 the decimal digit? Is that 1 the binary digit? Is that 1 the decimal digit? Like which one is that?
Yeah, like 111 is a valid number in all those systems, but has very different meaning depending on what your base is.
Yeah, no, it has to be it. So I mean, you could use notation, maybe a subscript to denote what type of digit it is, but usually the way we do it is, you know, just infer it based on the position. Or, you know, we say, hey, this is going to be a binary number. So in other words, you have to be told what it is. But when you run across, if you're a data scientist, you run across data, oftentimes you're not told what it is. So that could happen as well. But in a good data system, you should be told what it is. And good, like, if you're actually trying to use these things to communicate. The other thing about hexadecimal that I didn't mention is it interfaces really well with binary, because each hexadecimal digit being 16 is four bits. It's four ones and zeros. So it's almost a way to compress binary code in a very kind of dependable way. And you have, like, if you want to show 8 bits in a byte, it's like 2 hexadecimal digits. So it's really easy in that regard. Okay, so what was the Cora question? Let's get into that. So the core question was, if binary is base 2, and binary is ones and zeros, so it's like, okay, anytime you see a number that's 10000, you know that's a power of 2. Whereas, you know, in decimal, it's a power of 10. Is kind of freaky. I don't think I'll ever get used to the fact that 1-0 is 2, not 10. They asked, okay, what is base 1 and what is base 0? And then some people said it didn't exist. And then other people said that base 1 is tick marks. You know, hey, base 1 is means that there can only be one symbol. So I know a system with one symbol.
Makes sense that you can reduce the complexity that way.
Yeah, yeah. But I would argue that that's not what base 1 is if you follow the pattern down from base 10. So if you think about it, every time you go down, every time you remove a digit from your base, you reduce the number of digits available for each place. For example, if I am in base 10, right, and I have a 3-digit number, how many different possibilities do I have for a 3-digit number?
In base 10?
Yeah. I'm putting you on the spot here.
Well, is it 10 factorial? No, that's too many.
No. Yeah. No, it's just 000 to 999.
Okay.
Yeah. So
yeah. Oh yeah. 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 That makes
1,000,
sense.
Right. 10 to the third. And so then you go down to, let's use base 3, you know, a 3-digit number. It should be 3 to the third possibilities, right? Okay. So that would be, 27, right? And then let's say you're using binary and you have 2 to the third, right? So you have 8 possibilities.
Yep.
I could enumerate those 8. There's 000, 001, 010, 011, 100, 101, 110, and 111. That's all 8.
So representing 0 through 7.
Right, right, exactly. Okay, so let's go down to base 1. If I have 3 digits in base 1, how many possibilities should I have? So if base 10
What's 3 to the 1? Or is it 1 to the third?
1 to the third, right. One possibility. And so notice, look, if you're base 3, you have every time you go down a number, you remove the top digit. So base 1, there's only one digit, and that one digit is 0. Exactly. And so you can have a base 1 number system. Wouldn't be very useful, but essentially it would be something that's always 0. Now, I lied when I said it's not useful. It's actually... You'd actually be surprised that in type theory, in programming, this is very useful. It's a type called a unit, and a unit is a type where there's only one value available. So I know the answer is 0 going into it. Now, why would you have unit? You could have unit because, I'm going to get complicated, but you could have a system where it's like, hey, I want to have a list of something, and actually it's like, you know what, in this possibility I want a list of strings, over here I want a list of colors, and you know what, over here I want a list of units, and I know that's going to reduce to basically a list of units is just a count of something. And it could just be, now, why would I be doing that? It's just, you know, if you have some abstract system that you want to crunch down to something else, it's good for like trying to generalize stuff. If I'm getting into some like abstract type theory here, but sometimes it's very good when you have when you're trying to generalize ideas in computer science, oftentimes when you plug in that unit type, you can then, make it something very specific and very simple. Here's another example. This is not a good example. But I was thinking there's a concept called a map where I'm mapping some value to some other value. Like, let's say I'm mapping, people to scores, where I'm keeping score in a game.
Okay.
Right? And so, you know, maybe their scores are numbers. You know, you're playing a basketball game. Or I could map people to colors. Maybe it's like, you know, what what color jersey they're wearing. So I'm mapping people to colors. So then I can say, well, what if I map people to unit? Well, that's something that gives me no information, but maybe there's a situation where you just don't want to put any information there. So you just put unit, you know. So there's all sorts of different like uses and ways of describing things. I almost want to give it another example. Like, let's suppose you have you're exploding a three-digit number. Let's say you have 321. You know, we often say, when you teach kids, how to explode that number, it's 300s, 2 10s, and 1 1. You're gonna have to go through this with your kids in like 2 years, so you better pay attention.
We're getting there.
Now,
I tried to explain multiplication the other day.
Yeah.
It didn't go over well.
Now, when they get older, it's gonna be like, okay, this is 3 × 10^2, and 2 × 10^1, and 1 × 10^0. You might be like, well, why am I saying 10 to the zero there? Because that's one. It's not useful. It's like, no, it's really useful for completing the pattern. So anyway, I just went into a whole rant as to why unit is valuable. I'd actually argue that there's a case where we kind of do use a unit, and that is in time. So when you're talking about hours and seconds or minute, let's say you're doing times in minutes and seconds, right? You're using a positional notation there, but each digit is a different type of digit. So think about it this way. The ones digit on the seconds is a regular decimal digit, but the second digit on seconds only goes up to 5. It's a base 6. It only goes up to 5. And so you have base 6 and you have base 10 and you multiply that together to get 60. You've got 60 seconds. Okay, then on the minute side, you have the same thing going on. So you have on the second side, you have a base 10 digit. To the right of that is a base 6 digit. Then in the minutes, you have a base 10 digit. To the right of that is a base 6 digit. Oftentimes, in between the minutes and the seconds, what do you put in there?
A colon.
Okay. What if that colon is a base 1 digit? Think about it. It does work, right?
I don't know if my mind is blown or not.
Well, look, I mean, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference because that's just adding a base 1 digit to your number. It doesn't hurt anything. It doesn't give you any new information. Maybe it just helps. It helps with readability. Maybe the commas that we put are base 1 digits. So really, our decimal notation is 10 10 1, 10 10 1, 10 10 1. Something like that. So okay, that's crazy. Okay, so now then the question is, dun dun dun, even crazier, base 0. What happens on base 0? I'm going to let you guess.
It's the absence of a number, right? how can we have less than a single possible value?
Right. So, in Scala, which is the programming language we use at Foursquare, I said there's a type called unit. I think there's also a type called none type, and basically, if you say that a function returns none type, it will never compile because there's no value in that. There's no possible value that can return none type. I mean, unless you pass it another function that returns none type that it assumes exists, but then you can't build that one. And if I tell you that I have a number that is base 0, you don't even have the 0 digits. You don't have any digits. So you could say it's like a number system, but it's a null number system. There are no possible numbers that can be made through it, if that makes sense. Are you taking notes on this? Is this... Okay. like I said, for a base 1 digit, like you could add that colon, nothing happens. But if I add a single base 0 digit, it wipes away the whole thing. It's like multiplying by 0. The whole thing explodes and you can't have a number anymore. So... That's
as long
really
as you're
interesting.
Not dividing by 0.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you're just multiplying by Z. You're multiplying the number of, just like adding a base 10 digit, you multiply your possibilities by 10. When you add a base 0 digit, you multiply your possibilities by 0, thus negating all your possibilities. So I think the interesting takeaway is that base 1 and base 0 are real concepts, and actually in theoretical computer science, they do matter. And not only that, but it's actually built into programming languages, types like this. So they do have some kind of practical use, that's kind of fascinating. Now, I don't know if you have any questions before we move on to my idea of a factorial based number system.
I was going to ask, have you read Andy Weir's latest novel, Project Hail Mary?
No.
So I will not give any spoilers, but I will mention that I believe it's a base 6 number system comes into play.
Okay. Yeah. So. I mean, I think that was actually pretty common. I think those have been done in the ancient world, 6, 3, 60, 12. Those are very divisible numbers. So those are often used. Sometimes I wonder if there could be like a measure of divisibility, some kind of a objective measure, not just like how many factors something has, but like why is 12 more useful than 9, say, because 9 has 2 3s, you know, but, and you know, you kind of have a trade-off because 12 has more digits. Is there some like objective way to measure like how much more useful 12 is than say 14? I'd be interested.
This is getting dangerously close to a defense of the customary unit system, and why it is superior to metric.
Well, it's interesting. You know, that wasn't my intent. It certainly is a good reason for having. It's probably why the customary system has that divisibility. But I think they also found
in a pre-digital world, operating where things could be divided into fractions was perhaps more useful than breaking things into units of 10.
Yeah, yeah. But then there's a lot of use to standardize by 10 as well. So I'm not going to get into that whole debate. Sometimes I like having both systems because you could then compare and contrast and think about things differently, but that's a whole other thing. I posted about that once on Twitter. Everyone got mad at me. All right. So here's my idea for a factorial-based number system, okay? So imagine this number system. The ones digit is base 1, so it's always 0. The next digit over is base 2. The next digit over is base 3. The next digit over is base 4, so on and so forth. At some point, you run out of digits, but let's say we go A through Z. So let's say you can't make it more than 36 digits into it.
There are other letters in other alphabets. You could stretch it.
Sure. We could stretch it, but let's keep it way smaller than that for now. So first of all, what's really interesting, if you take a certain... a certain subsection of those digits, let's say like the first 4, you have a unit digit, a binary digit, a 2's digit, and a 3's digit. How many possibilities is that? If you multiply them together, that's 3 factorial, 1 times 2 times 3. Now, if you look at the numbers that are like 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, whereas in binary, they're factors of 2. In decimal, they're factors of 10. In this system, those are actually factorials. So every factorial would be like 7 factorial would be 1, 0, 0, 0, et cetera. And so if you wanted to up the factorial on that, all you would have to do is add a 0, which I imagine that in terms of like combinatorial computation, there's got to be some use for that.
I was going to say, what's the discipline where that could be particularly useful? And I was thinking, probability.
Yeah.
But I couldn't say exactly where within that this would be particularly.
Well, it would be nice. Like if you have five items, you know, 5 factorial is the number of permutation of those items. Now, one way to represent the permutations is to just have each of those 5 items represent a digit, right? And then just, you know, write those digits in whatever order that permutation is. But another way to represent that permutation is to say, okay, line up those 5 items. Then let's say, okay, I'm going to take the 4th one. I have a 4. And now there are 4 left. I'm going to take the 0th one. I'm going to add a 0. Okay. Now I'm going to, there are 3 left. I will take the 2nd one, and so on and so forth. And you can build up a number that way. And that would be one of those binary digits. And then they become addable. They become, you know, there's a certain sequence to them. And so I feel like that's sort of a different way to explore permutations of items that has not been done recently. And so that's just an idea. I haven't written a paper on it. I haven't looked for it in the literature. But I'm sure it's there. Maybe it's not there. Maybe I should. maybe I should write it. But I don't know.
It's vaguely reminiscent of changing coordinate systems or not necessarily changing coordinate systems, but changing geometries. You know, going from Cartesian I'm blanking.
Euclidean to non-Euclidean.
Thank you. That's what I was thinking. Euclidean and non-Euclidean spaces, and that you can apply the same operations, but it has completely different results.
Right. Right. And then, you know, I think there's a broader question that I would ask, like, what is a digit? So, like, we often think of digits as, okay, there's a finite number of them. I think you still have to have a finite number of them. I think that's got to be a general rule because otherwise they're not usable. Okay, so there are a finite number of them. We feel like they should have a certain order. Is that necessary? Could you build a digit system where maybe the digits don't have an order, or maybe they have like a pre-order where maybe there's I don't know. I'm not gonna speculate. But there's all sorts of different takes on digits that I could see could be used to build up really interesting data structures in computer science and mathematics. I'm not gonna attempt to do that in the format of a radio show today. Although I feel like I want to go up to this whiteboard that I have in the room and do some. I feel like I got to get one of those detachable microphones to get the sound looks good. I don't know if I could I could just hold this and do some whiteboarding up there. That wouldn't be part of the local maximum. That would be just another extra video I put out. So
we'll get you doing a whiteboard session soon.
I hope so. All right. Any last thoughts on today before we wrap up?
Well, I asked previously if you had a favorite base, but do you have a favorite digit?
Ooh, yes. Yes, I do. It's my favorite number. I am a fan of the number 4. And I think it's because it's like, you know, 4 is the only digit that is like, you know, I guess this puts 2 in the equation, but 2 plus 2 equals 2 times 2 equals 2 to the power of 2. It's like, it's like almost every, and then if you take like Ackermann functions of 2, which is beyond power, it still goes to 4. There's something about 4 where like the symmetry of it, really appeals to me. I like other numbers too, but, 4, I think, I'm 4 is just my go-to. I don't know what that says about me. I don't know if that gets into like numerology, some weird stuff. I don't know if that means I have some psychological issues, but 4 is my number. Do you have a favorite one?
Well, before we go there, I have to ask, I have no idea what this answer is going to tell me one way or
okay,
the other.
Okay.
But when you write a 4, is the top of your 4 a U-shape or a triangle shape?
A U-shape.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I still have no idea what I've learned from your answer there.
But that doesn't
It has no impact on the mathematical properties of the number. It's completely a a typography, question.
I can imagine that for some people, like that's the reason they like the four is how it's typed.
The aesthetic.
Yeah, I don't think I think I could write it as a triangle. And I think
a lot of people like 8 at infinity for that. It's an aesthetically pleasing symbol.
I could see it. Well, you know, people have realized. The ancients have realized that different numbers. It's not just a never-ending sequence and they all look the same. Each number has kind of, especially the small numbers, have kind of a different personality because there are very different ways that they can be broken down and systems kind of, there are a lot of systems that break into 2 and a different type of system might break into 3 and 4. And so there are qualitative differences as these numbers appear in nature. Based on their mathematical properties. So that could be a whole other area of exploration to talk about, because I don't even know where to begin with that, but definitely something people are interested in.
Well, it just reminded me that I'm currently reading another Neal Stephenson book. So we mentioned the Metaverse and Snow Crash earlier, which has several mathematical proofs sprinkled in there. Just because he needed to fill up the footnotes or something. So perhaps I will report back in several months when I finish reading it. What I've learned about mathematics and natural philosophy on that adventure.
All right, perfect. Maybe I'll interview that for another episode. All right, so that about wraps it up today. I think we had a good show today. We didn't even fall asleep. It's already 1 in the morning, 1:30 in the morning, so perfect. All right, these are the best shows, the one that we do in 1 in the morning. Anyway, all right. Lots of great, we have a lot of great topics lined up. I don't have a lot of guests, so if anyone has some ideas, get me some guests, but I'm finding some new ones.
Mark Zuckerberg, if you're listening and you want to come in and talk about the metaverse, open invitation.
Oh, yes. That would be a good thing because I don't want to just complain about Facebook with him. I would absolutely talk about the metaverse. All right. So that's a positive note to end on. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support the Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.